My name's Ed Howard. I'm with the Alliance for Health Reform. And I want to welcome, on behalf of our board and Senator Rockefeller, our honorary chairman, welcome you to this third in a four-part series of briefings on the deficit reduction work that's now underway in Congress. In fact, reaching a critical stage with the so-called super committee due to act by the day before Thanksgiving. Today we're going to look at the Medicaid program in the context of deficit reduction. Medicaid costs federal and state governments a whole potload of money, about $400 billion last year, with the federal government picking up more than half of that. It also serves a huge number of people, depending on how you measure it, somewhere between 60 and 70 million. And when the economy's ailing, Medicaid's enrollment and its costs grow even more. That means budget cutters in states have already homed in on Medicaid as a target, and everybody who's concerned about federal deficits are eyeing the program as well. And that brings us to the reason for today's briefing. You'll note that, like the others in this series, it's going to run slightly longer than our normal session, going to end at 2 o'clock, having begun pretty close to noon. We hope that that will allow us to get a closer look at some aspects of the issue. And what's more, there are two distinct panels. First, a historical perspective on the program by a couple of high-ranking former federal officials who helped run Medicaid. And second, a look at what is actually happening to the program and those it serves in the country today. And you'll have a chance to ask questions after each of those panels. As I said, it's the third of our deficit reduction briefings, and in early December, if the super committee does what it is expected to do under the statute, we'll have a wrap-up examination of its recommendations or lack thereof to end this series. You'll also notice that we have four co-sponsors for this briefing and for all of our four briefings in the series: the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, the Commonwealth Fund, the SCAN Foundation, and the Kaiser Family Foundation. There's background information on a sheet in your kits. Thank each of them for their support for this series, which allowed us to get it off the ground fast and to obviously attract a very important and sophisticated audience to be educated about this topic. We're joined by representatives of two of those sponsors, the Kaiser Family Foundation and the SCAN Foundation, with their top leadership to co-moderate this discussion with me. And we're going to start by hearing from those leaders: Bruce Chernoff, who's the president and CEO of the SCAN Foundation, and Diane Rowland, who's the executive vice president of the Kaiser Family Foundation. We've asked them not only to moderate, but to get us off to a good start by providing a sort of factual and policy context for this discussion. There's biographical information on them and on all of our speakers in your packets, but let me just say, Diane heads the Foundation's Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured, and she chairs the new Congressional Advisory Commission on Medicaid and CHIP. Dr. Chernoff, he's an internist by training, before coming to SCAN, directed the Los Angeles County Health Department. So we have not only two sharp co-moderators, we really have two more experts for all of us to be educated by, and I'm looking forward to that experience. And I'm going to start by turning to Kaiser Family Foundation's Diane Rowland. There you go.
Well, welcome, and it's great to see such a large turnout today and to have you with us to talk about Medicaid. So my role at the beginning of this forum is just to paint a few pictures of the facts about Medicaid. And the first one, which of course we all know all too well, is that Medicaid provides a substantial share today of the health and long-term care coverage for about 16% of our population, and it accounts for roughly an equivalent 17% of overall health care spending. So we have a program that covers lots of people in a health care system that's very expensive. But what we mostly have to remember about Medicaid is that it's more than health insurance. While it does provide health insurance coverage to 29 million children, 15 million adults in low-income families, and another 15 million elderly and persons with disability, it really is a source of substantial assistance to those who are low-income and on our Medicare program, providing wraparound services, filling in their cost-sharing, helping with their premiums. And it is the most substantial financer today of long-term care services, covering over 1 million individuals in nursing homes and another nearly 3 million who receive long-term care services through the community. So in that role, it provides about 16% of our overall health care spending and about 40% of all of our spending on long-term care. And as the states will tell you, it is a major source of their revenue from the federal government, but also a substantial share of what they spend in terms of providing health and long-term care services for their citizens. If we look at the Medicaid program, the slide that always bears in mind what some of the challenges are in any attempt to reduce spending on this program, the face of the program is largely children and many of their parents, but the spending in the program is largely for the elderly and disabled population, so that you see if you reduce coverage for many of the low-income families on the program, that is not where the major dollars in the program are vested. And what we can see so clearly from this slide is the reason that the per capita spending on children and adults in the program is relatively low, around $2,000 or more a year, compared to some nearly $15,000 per capita for people with disabilities and another $13,000 per capita for the elderly who also have Medicare coverage. You see, the elderly spending is predominantly there on long-term care services, but I want you to bear in mind that when you look at the per capita spending for people with disabilities, you're looking not only at people who have dual eligible coverage and have Medicare, but you're looking at many of the duals, in fact, the majority of the disability population that is not a dual population, but is instead covered for both acute and long-term care services under the Medicaid program. So that population has very substantial acute care spending and no Medicare benefits to wrap around. And finally, we do always hear about the duals. They've gone from being duly eligible for Medicare and Medicaid to the shorthand duals. The individuals in this group account for a relatively small share of the Medicaid population, 15%, but they account for a substantial share, nearly 40% of overall Medicaid spending. Much of that spending is on long-term care services, but as you can see from this slide, some of that spending is on premium assistance that is provided to help pay the Medicare premiums, and some for filling in the acute care gaps in the Medicare program itself. And I know Bruce Chernoff is going to talk a little more about this particular population and some of the challenges facing them. What I wanted to close with, however, is that Medicaid is often characterized because of its size and because of the drain that is experienced by some of the states in trying to meet their share of Medicaid financing as a program that is out of control. But what we actually see here is that over the last decade, Medicaid spending per capita has actually risen slower than national health expenditures per capita or than the monthly premiums for employer-sponsored coverage. So this program has been a well-managed program. I think some of our state representatives will talk about much that has been done within the program to try and restrain spending on a per capita basis. What we really see in the Medicaid program is that it is enrollment and it is economic downturns that drive much of the spending. And here you see that in the period of our last recession, and some would say our continuing recession, even though not official, the average annual growth in the program from 2007 to 2009 was largely driven by enrollment growth. The spending per enrollee actually was lower than over the last decade. And that has led, of course, in the earlier days of this recession to a bump up in the federal matching rates, that the federal government matches the state expenditures. We have now returned back down to the historical spending levels for matching rates for the Medicaid program, which has put even more pressure on state budgets at this point. At a time now when we're returning to the original FMAP levels, when states are experiencing unemployment rates that are actually higher today than they were when the enhanced federal matching was put into place. So a lot of challenges in figuring out where the spending is going, a lot of challenges in looking at how to curtail spending in a program that covers some 60 million people, many of our poorest and sickest citizens. Thank you.
Very good. Bruce?
So what I want to do at this point is really build on Diane's excellent overview and comments. Before I hop in, I just want to take a sec. I know both Diane and I and the other foundations who've helped support this series want to take a moment and acknowledge Ed and the entire team at the Alliance for Health Reform for putting together this excellent set of sessions. We think the most important thing is to get some of the detail out about each of these programs and what it means in the context of both the supercommittee work as well as the larger discussion around entitlement reforms that we're all involved in. So with that, what I wanted to do was pick up a bit on Diane's framework and talk really about what this means for duals and to look at the duals through a couple of different lenses. You know, let's start by saying that there really are kind of four populations, and Diane called them out in her work. If you think about the historical origins of Medicaid, its primary origins were as a program for women of childbearing age and their kids. But over time, the program has really grown to serve some other populations, the seniors and people with disabilities who are Medicaid only, as well as the dual population, of which there are about 9 million people. But it's really important that when people think about duals, of that 9 million, only 60% are older, 40% are younger. So even within the duals population, kind of our simplest notions about who's in what bucket isn't entirely accurate. And then I want to call out the hidden population, sort of building on Diane's work. And that hidden population, and we'll come to them again at the very end of my thoughts, are the Medicare individuals who have chronic conditions and some functional limitations. So they have serious health care needs, and they're functionally limited. They look and feel like a dual, but they're not a dual yet. And there's a significant percentage of people who are out there, and in tough economic times, those are folks that are on the cusp of going from one program to being part of both. What these data show you very clearly is that, again, and highlighting what Diane brought up before, government is the largest purchaser of long-term care services in this country. Let's just put that on the table. Medicaid is the largest purchaser within government. Why is this so? Why is it important now? 70% of people over the age of 65 will need some form of long-term services and supports as they age. So one more time, 70% of people over the age of 65 will need some form of long-term services and supports. This is really important because I think in most people's minds, if you guys were to close your eyes and think about your parents or family members that you've cared for, it's like, that happens over there, lightning strikes somewhere else, but it doesn't strike me. But what the data clearly show is that's not true. Well, we will all more than likely need a little bit of support at some point in our lives, but that doesn't necessarily mean nursing homes. So for lots of folks, this could mean home and community-based services. And this becomes an important point because what model are we using? Is it predominantly a medical model to solve a social problem? How does the medical model and the social model link to one another? What are the implications for that from a policy and a program perspective? What we see across the country has been a real effort to recognize that people generally want to remain in the community. Skilled nursing facilities are, you know, for a subset of the population, they're really important. They're the right place to get care, but for many people, they provide a level of service that a certain individual might not need. You might be better off in the community, and those services have the potential to be less expensive, and so over time, states have built out their home and community-based services program. Although it's very important to remember that the skilled nursing facility is an entitlement and the home and community-based services are not. They're predominantly provided through state plan, through waiver options, that kind of thing. And it's also, I guess, important to say that even to this day, still the majority of the dollars go to nursing home care. When we look across the country, you begin to see how long-term care dollars are spent, and home and community-based services are a growing percentage. We now have, you know, slightly more than a handful of states that are at 50% plus, and many other states have built out their programs just under the 50% level. And you have states like Washington, for example, that have gone a really long way in their rebalancing, in that not only have they expanded home and community-based services, but they've actually slowed the growth of their institutional care. So trying to find a full rebalancing of services. You know, when we think of the duals, it's really important. We're here to talk about Medicaid today. That's the purpose of today's discussion. But if you're dually eligible, you don't just live in that one program. You live in both, and you live in the great joy of trying to manage your services, because it's generally the person and their families or caregivers that have to manage the services across those two programs. And everybody in the room knows about those challenges, and many of those challenges were described in the previous session on Medicare. But just to call out the point that 17% of the Medicare population are duals, but they represent 28% of those with five or more chronic conditions. The point here being that the duals population is generally sicker than the average population. That's true on the Medicare side, and it's true on the Medicaid side. Duals are more likely to use healthcare services than other beneficiaries. True on the Medicaid side, but also true on the Medicare side. The reality is that these folks are sicker, but I'm bringing up the Medicare data here to show you that this service utilization drives cost. And as you start to think about a duals population, when you don't get the services you need on the home and community-based side or in an organized way in the broader long-term care system, those costs have a way of popping out on the acute care side, like emergency room utilization and inpatient care. When you start to look at the older duals, so the subset of duals that is, in fact is over 65, have chronic conditions and functional impairment, those folks actually utilize a lot more services and are frankly more expensive because they are sicker and have needs both on the medical and the social side of the ledger. I want to leave you with the last thought before I turn it back to Ed. So why is that point important, going back to the fourth population? Well, 50% of those individuals who are Medicare eligible, who have chronic conditions and functional limitations, the most expensive folks in the Medicare system, are duals. But fully 50% of those Medicare individuals who have chronic conditions and functional needs are not duals. So they represent the kind of ticking time bomb that's out there for the Medicaid program. You know, some of those people will never spend down to the point where they're duals, but a lot of those people in these economic times are much closer than they were even a few years ago. So the challenge of an aging population as the boomers move through their retirement years and what that means for public programs is really important. So thinking about the whole person, particularly the whole seriously ill, functionally limited person, is critical when you start to think about Medicare and Medicaid and the interactions between those two programs. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Bruce. A little bit of housekeeping. There are materials in your packets, including biographical information, all of our speakers and our co-moderators. There is a similar but larger set of materials online at both allhealth.org, our website, and KFF.org. Kaiser Family Foundation website includes, as of tomorrow, or maybe Monday, because tomorrow is a holiday, a webcast of this briefing, and we'll have a transcript for you on our website sometime next week. There are blue evaluation forms we hope you will fill out before you leave, and green question cards that you'll have ample opportunity to use today, and we would encourage you at that point. Let's get to the program. We have, in addition to our expert co-moderators, a terrific group of other experts, and we're going to start by hearing from two people with hands-on experience with Medicaid at the federal level, among other things. Tim Westmoreland, who's a visiting professor of law and senior scholar in health law at Georgetown, ran the Medicaid program in what is now CMS from 1999 to 2001. Tony McCann was Assistant Secretary for Management at HHS, recently retired as CFO at the Federal Health Resources and Services Administration within HHS. And, oh, yes, he ran Medicaid for Maryland there for a previous administration in one of his former lives. Thank you both for being willing to give us a little historical perspective on this very important, complex, and large program that we've just heard described. And let's start with Tim to fill our audience in.
And let them know there's seats up front.
And once again, there are seats up front for those of you who are, like I, unable to stand for long periods of time without your back aching.
Last time I checked, we don't bite.
I need to begin by saying thank you to the Alliance and the sponsors for inviting me to be here. I appreciate the opportunity. I also need to begin with a couple of initial disclaimers. The first one is that the views I present are my own. They should not be construed to represent past, present, or maybe someday future employers. I say that because I want to make clear that Georgetown University and others do not have, I'm not speaking on their behalf today. The other disclaimer, which some people may find disappointing, but it's the best I can do, is I'm speaking without any insider information about the proceedings of the supercommittee or the people advising the supercommittee. So I'm on my own here. In thinking about deficit reduction, the budget, and the Medicaid program, I want to make four basic points about Medicaid as it exists. First, that Medicaid's needs grow countercyclically with the economy, so cutting it in a recession is doubly bad. Second, that over and above its good works, the things that Medicaid does well, Medicaid is itself a stimulus program in state and local economies. Third, like all spending, public and private, domestic and defense, it is subject to waste, fraud, and abuse, but efforts to deal with waste, fraud, and abuse are already underway in the Medicaid program and, probably more significantly for this audience, already built into baseline. And finally, that lots of the current system of health care itself and of the Affordable Care Act on its way are built on Medicaid, and any cuts today will be tomorrow's workability problems in the healthcare industry and in the Affordable Care Act. So let me go back. Needs growing countercyclically. Medicaid is always, as Diane has pointed out to you, filled with the oldest and the sickest and the most vulnerable people. Look at the recent publication of the Kaiser Foundation's Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured and just see some of the stories that they have to tell, the faces of Medicaid publication, to see the individual narratives of who these people are. They're kids with genetic illnesses, their families losing their jobs and health insurance, they're adults with disabilities who are trying to stay at home and not in a nursing home. And on top of that, the people who are always in the Medicaid program these days, meaning since 2007, there are more people without jobs and therefore with less employer-sponsored insurance. There are more employers dropping employer-sponsored insurance as a benefit to provide to their employees. And the individual workers have less disposable income to pay out-of-pocket costs, which are growing much faster than income is in this country. There are fewer state revenues at the time, right now, you all know that your states are broke, fewer state revenues to pay the difference. So we turn to the Medicaid program. And cutting Medicaid at this moment, with all of those storms going on, is, to my mind, like cutting FEMA during the middle of a hurricane, or during the middle of a flood, or during the middle of an earthquake. This is when we need Medicaid most, in a counter-cyclical way. The need is highest, the other resources available to meet those needs are lowest, and therefore it is substantively bad to cut Medicaid at this point. Over and above the health benefits of having Medicaid, the federal spending is also an economic stimulus. Unemployment in this country right now is steady and, in some sectors, growing unemployment. One of the biggest areas of job loss is in state and local government, I think people will point out. And as state revenues continue to fall, so do the payrolls at state and local government. Medicaid can help with state revenues. Aside from building new military bases in a state, not much from the federal government is as efficient as getting money to the state and local governments as the Medicaid program. It's at least a one-to-one match for state dollars, and in many states it can go as high as 4-to-1 match. The feds will pay $4 for every dollar the state puts up, and it's on an ongoing basis. So it's a stimulus that doesn't go away and run off a cliff. Moreover, Medicaid, by virtue of what kinds of services it buys, is outlaid right away. It gets into local people's pockets. It's not saved. It's not waiting for shovel-ready projects. And these are local jobs. It's not generally subject to outsourcing when you're talking about home and community-based service workers, when you're talking about nursing homes, when you're talking about poverty clinics. These jobs stay in the U.S. and stay in state and local areas. So cutting Medicaid during the middle of a recession is anti-stimulus. It's costing local jobs at a time when it is the public sector that is contributing the most to unemployment. Now, there is a perennial call in Medicaid for us to cut waste, fraud, and abuse. Now, my first note in this is it's hardly unique to Medicaid or to health or to government. Anyone who says that they want the government to be run like a business has to be really sure that he's not asking it to be run like Enron or Bernie Madoff or AIG. So waste, fraud, and abuse is all around us as a necessary product of the move to try to make one's money better. It's there. It's the part of incentives and capitalism. Indeed, Medicaid, as Diane has shown you, has a lower overhead and better administrative costs than the private sector does. But nonetheless, that doesn't mean you can sit still. As a former director of the Medicaid program, I can promise you that I spent, as a federal official, more time trying to stop the abuses than on any other issue in the Medicaid program. I spent lots of time and have the stripes to prove it, to say that I found and eliminated an accounting game called upper payment limits that the CBO said, if I didn't do something about it, would cost more than $100 billion by itself over 10 years without expanded services for the beneficiaries. I shut it down. And the states have been actively searching out waste for decades, too, and they're doing good work. They've been cutting there, too. And so I know that there is waste, fraud, and abuse, and I know that there's pressure to cut the program to get to the waste, fraud, and abuse. But I'm saying that people need to find the waste before they decide to cut it. And I'm concerned that people are thinking of cutting the money and hoping that it's just the waste that gets cut. We're past that. Cuts that aren't targeted at specific programs are now cutting real services to the people who need them, the elderly, disabled, and families with kids. Nonpartisan, both parties, I'm sure my friend Tony McCann too, are opposed to waste, fraud, and abuse. I have a few definitional questions along the way. One man's waste is another man's good purchase. For me, the fact that we pay more for Medicare prescription drugs than we do for Medicaid prescription drugs is a form of waste and abuse in the Medicare program. But that's the Congress's decision. It's not unknown to you guys. But all of us are opposed to billing for services that aren't provided or working elder law programs to make big transfers of assets invisible. That's no news. And as I say, most important for today's discussion around the supercommittee, CBO and OMB have already built some levels of catching waste, fraud, and abuse into their baselines. So new proposals, unless they're incredibly creative, unless they're brand new ideas, are unlikely to produce any real savings. And if you produce real savings with something that's blunt, you're probably cutting into real services. It's too easy for people to say that waste, fraud, and abuse are just sitting there. Finally, I want to say that lots of our health system, present and future, is built on Medicaid. As Diane was pointing out, 60 million people are already on Medicaid. And not just the people are depending on it, the providers are too. Public hospitals, community health centers, free clinics, the entire safety net is kept on life support by the availability of the Medicaid program. And there are more to come, because the ACA is broadening it to all poor people, not just poor people with something else, the categories of poor and pregnant, or poor and elderly, or poor and disabled. It's a good thing to get rid of this categorical eligibility and focus only on income. Indeed, the first person I know of who ever proposed getting rid of categorical eligibility was Gail Wilensky, who was doing it for President Bush 1. And it will be efficient for states not to have to focus on the categories in determining eligibility, but just look at income. But it means we're going to have millions of new childless adults entering Medicaid by 2014. And if we run the program into the ground right now with provider rates that attract no providers, then these new people will have no source of care. If only the safety net providers take Medicaid patients, those providers are going to be swamped, and CHCs, public health hospitals, free clinics, they won't have the space to take care of them. So the future of our current system and of the expanded ACA is dependent on Medicaid. All of which is to say, in conclusion, that Medicaid is exactly the wrong place at exactly the wrong time to find super committee cuts and savings. The needs have been big for a long time, and the recession and the aging of the baby boomers mean that they're greater now. There are more people who are low income, more people with no health insurance, more people who are old. There is no vaccine to make the elderly young again, or to end disabilities, or to give people health insurance. Also, other resources are low now, especially at the states. And the stimulus effect is worthwhile. Medicaid is good for state and local economies. There isn't any low-hanging fruit of waste, fraud, and abuse, or any that the states haven't already found and built into their programs. If anything, I believe it's now time to renew the unemployment-related increases in federal matching payments to Medicaid, as Diane's slide showed, recognizing that the states are hurting bad and their citizens are hurting worse, and we should be taking up some more of that burden at exactly this moment. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Tim. Tony?
Well, I too, first of all, being retired, I don't have to notice that I'm not representing anybody unless you want to count Social Security and the federal retirement system. I too want to thank the group for giving me the chance to be with my friend Tim and to be on a panel with some really heavyweight health professionals. It's not bad for an old appropriator, and I was an old appropriator. I want to discuss three things, if I can. The first is some issues as they relate to revenues and spending, because the problem is worse than you think it is. The second is to talk a little bit about the way I saw it from the ground level, the way I saw Medicaid from the ground level. And the third, having worked on the Senate Budget Committee back in the 1980s when we did the original reconciliation bills and Graham Rudman, a little bit about what you're up against. First of all, keep in mind that it's unlikely that the revenues that people are hoping for or counting on are probably going to appear. The first problem is, of course, the alternative minimum tax. You all are familiar with it. I'm not going to go through it, but I would raise this point because it is important as we go forward. The reason the alternative minimum tax is a problem is because it was created at a time when we were going to hit it only to rich people. But we didn't index the thresholds, and therefore it is now hitting more and more people, and the Congress has begun to waive it. That will come back again. The second is a chart which I put together, which shows the historic take of the federal government with respect to revenues. And as you can see, from 1955 until about 2009, the federal government took between 18 and 19% of our gross domestic product. The more important thing, however, is that every time it inched above that, the political system generated a coalition, if you will, and we cut taxes. We cut it for Kennedy in the 1960s, we cut it for Reagan in the 1980s, and we cut it in the Bush administration in the early 2000s. Now, I'm not enough of a statistician to know whether three data points is a trend, but it's not random either. And the point is that if you look at the baseline going forward from CBO, it shows that it would go substantially higher under current law. And even if you stopped indexing the alternative minimum tax, and even if you eliminated the Bush tax cuts, all of them, you are still going to be substantially above 20% of gross domestic product. Now, maybe the shock of the last 2 years will change people's mind, and whatever the process was, that brought forth these tax cuts from time to time have ended. But maybe they haven't. And if you're a betting man or woman, I wouldn't bet on revenues above 19% of our gross domestic product. On the spending side, we have a couple of issues, again, to make the problem a little more difficult. First is the sustainable growth rate for Medicare physicians. We managed to sweep that one under the rug when we were doing the Affordable Care Act, and it's still out there. It's still $300 billion that someone has to find before we can begin, if we're going to fix it, before we begin to start talking about deficit reduction. And you can't do 1.2 trillion down and 300 up. That doesn't seem to me to make a lot of sense. So we've got that problem out there. And we've got a series within the Affordable Care Act. We've already lost $81 billion when, surprise, surprise, the CLASS Act was determined to be not viable. We also have in the Affordable Care Act Medicare tax increase and the increase in the Part B premium, and frankly, the tax on high-cost insurance. All three of them have elements of the same problem with that the alternative minimum tax has. That is, in the first two, the thresholds are not indexed, and in the third case, they're indexed to a factor that grows more slowly than the program itself. More and more people will be swept into it, and sooner or later, the Congress will step in. So the savings that are scored in the Affordable Care Act, and therefore in the baseline for those items, will not be completely realized. The last one, the Medicare provider productivity, it's not a tax. I must apologize for that. I put the slides together myself, and to paraphrase an old legal comment, he who has an assistant has a fool for a boss. And but the point is that factor will take Medicare hospital rates below Medicaid hospital rates by the end of the decade. The Medicare actuary has said that he doesn't believe it's going to happen. I don't believe it's going to happen, and I don't think anybody else believes it's going to happen either. So whatever the numbers are, the point is that, too, is going to get limited, and therefore the problem that we face is going to be bigger than the one we think we have. Now, I want to shift and talk a little bit about the program the way I saw it at the local level and the way I think you should think about it if you're talking about changing it, cutting it, reforming it, whatever. Because the way you've seen it presented to you has been displaying it as in the federal terms. What I saw was acute care Medicare, acute care, which responds just like you all think it does with respect as health policy people. The second was long-term care for the elderly. That's a much different set of programs. The issues and the incentives and the records and so forth are completely different. It is a different program, and it is probably not justifiably called a health program. In Maryland, we use some money for alcohol, drug abuse, and mental health services. They, too, are provided in a completely different location. There's a completely different notion of what constitutes outcomes. There's virtually no record systems whatsoever, so the ideas of improving through the use of medical records and so forth is just not there. So once again, it is a completely different program. And then for people with developmental disabilities, we're spending a lot of money, as has been spoken earlier. But remember, we're doing this not as a cost reduction option, because I frankly, at this point, don't think it does, but we're doing it simply because that's the way we believe these human beings should be treated. So the point is that they, too, are living in the communities. It's a community support program. It is not a health care program, per se, and it needs to be thought of differently. And if you do not do that and try and reform Medicare, Medicaid without doing it, you will not succeed. Deficit reductions. In the 1970s, first as a preface, in the 1970s, of course, immediately after passing Medicare and Medicaid, the programs had explosive growth. So by the mid-1970s, somebody said, well, you know, a good health policy guy said, hey, I got an idea. Why don't we find a way to give a single organization complete responsibility to manage the care and to take care of it and give them one payment? Kaiser does it. Why not? So we did. And we sent out grant money, and we sent out Medicare and Medicaid money and got those things going. And what happened? Well, a few places, HMOs developed. People got good care and so forth. In a lot of places, very well-meaning organizations got into the program, found out they didn't know how to manage it, and then backed out, went bankrupt, or otherwise dropped their patients without care. And, of course, we also had a few crooks in the process. So the HMO industry went from white hat to black hat. We let it sit for a while, and then about 10 years later, somebody says, well, what we ought to do is we ought to bundle all the payments together and give somebody the authority to manage, and we call them MCOs, Managed Care Organization. Basically, those places have had it happen as it is today. Finally, these organizations now have ACOs. My view of what an MCO did in the state of Maryland was that they were able to negotiate lower prices as for openers. They didn't manage care. And given the fact that we set the overall payment rates, they had two options. They could go out and they could manage more efficiently. They could encourage the organizations to manage more efficiently. They could get different kinds of programs in place and so forth. Or they could go down to Annapolis and hire the richest and best lobbyists they could find to get the legislature to overturn our proposals. Guess what they did? Lastly, if you want to think about the committee, you might want to think about it like the Super Bowl. Except don't think of it like the Super Bowl. Think of it as the first play in the Super Bowl. Remember, throughout the 1980s and into the 1990s, we had 11 separate reconciliation bills that were supposed to, number one, finish the job, and number two, were done with the same kind of excruciating difficulty that we're going through now. 11 times we did it. What I think happens, frankly, is that we didn't do much of anything. What happened is we proved that if you overheat the American economy, you can probably reduce the deficit or eliminate it. But, oh my God, the drying out afterwards with the bubbles we created and now with the financial upheavals that we have created. So let me close by guaranteeing you a couple of things. Number one, whatever the super committee does, the next year when CBO puts the baseline together, the savings that were scored in the bill will have been reduced substantially in the baseline. The savings will have been reduced. And the economy, because they'll have rosy scenario, you can bet your bottom dollar on it, the economy will have done more poorly, and therefore the budget problem will be back again. Therefore, this is the first step in a very long process. And if we're going to do it, everybody's got to contribute. Because sooner or later, if we're not careful, it's not going to be the Pelosi's and the Boehner's and Reed's and so forth of this world that are telling us what's to do. It's going to be our historic friends, the bankers, our traditional friends, the oil states and the Russians, and our new friends, the Chinese and the Brazilians. And they don't care about Medicaid. So we need to do it. We need to do it hard. But don't think this is the end. This is just the first step. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks very much. There are, we're going to take time for you to ask some questions of Tony and or Tim. There are microphones in the back of the room. Probably that's more efficient than trying to fill out a question card on short answer. And I would also encourage you, if you do have questions about any of the material that Bruce or Diane presented, feel this is the opportunity to clarify that as well. Let me just take the opportunity while you're figuring out what to do with your opportunity to try Tim on a point that you made about, maybe the point that you made about this being a bad time to think about cutting Medicaid. And I wonder if there are any UPLs in today's program. That is, are there inefficiencies that would allow the super committee or anybody else in a position to make a decision to reduce the projected spending in Medicaid without harming care or coverage?
UPLs was only the most recent manifestation of it. I mean, we had DSH hospitals to begin with, we had provider taxes after that, and then we had UPLs. Half jokingly and half seriously, I'd suggest that maybe the people who run state Medicaid programs would be better qualified to tell me what's out there at this time, because it took 5 years to find the UPL before we could undo them again. I don't know systemically of Medicaid gaming schemes that are out there right now of making the federal government pay more without actually changing the quality of the services that are there. I've heard discussions of looking at upper payment limits as, and believe me, this is too, I mean, we could spend 3 hours discussing upper payment limits here, but now setting the upper payment limit and then having people unbundle the services that were initially included in the market basket to get the UPL so that you pay twice. I've heard these rumors. I can't actually tell you that they exist. These programs exist. But right now, I think in the Medicaid program, as I read the stories that are coming out of the states, it's not those kinds of things that are driving state costs. What seems to be driving state costs right now is increases in enrollment. It's not like the services per beneficiary are exploding beyond belief, which is what UPL looked like, or what DSH looked like, or what provider taxes. It made it look like the beneficiaries were extraordinarily expensive when they weren't, because it was a financing mechanism. These days, the data look like we're getting a whole lot more enrollees in the Medicaid program, a whole lot more than were expected. And I don't see how you can game that. And in fact, as the states go through and have to roll back any of the payments and the methods, you know, they're coming to the Congress and saying, please let us disenroll people. So if you're holding on to enrollment, then that by itself is what's making the exploding cost.
Okay. Well, thank you. And if we don't have any questions of our first panel, let me invite our second panel to join us, and we'll build on the description of the program as it has developed by looking at the program as it is today. We're going to hear two people who are well acquainted with how Medicaid is working right now at both the state and personal levels. Andy Allison heads the Division of Healthcare Finance within the Kansas Department of Health and the Environment, and also chairs the board of the National Association of Medicaid Commissioners. Deanne Friedholm directs the Campaign for Health Reform at Consumers Union, and as a benefit to us, also happens to have run the Medicaid program in Texas in a prior life. So we're very pleased to have you with us, and let's start with Andy about the program today.
Thank you, Ed, and thank you to the Alliance, to the funders on behalf of the nation's Medicaid directors for the opportunity to talk about this very important subject at a very critical time. What I want to share with you today actually sounds a lot like what you've heard already, repackaged and with a state focus and hopefully a very sharp point It's the time for such sharp points in the Medicaid program, and I want to take advantage of that. And so the first thing I want to do, if that works, is like Tom, focus on revenues first. This is a picture of hope that you're seeing. This is the rosy scenario. It is CBO's projection of gross domestic product over the next several years. And you would see if it was the fact that tax rates remain constant at the state and federal level, you'd see a proportion of that taken out for state revenue. So just think of this as a picture of the tax base. Certainly it is for the most part. And what you see here in 2014 to 2016 is a dramatic recovery. It just comes back. And so the language up here says this is potential. This is potential GDP, a level corresponding to a high rate of use of labor and capital. And if you've read anything about Europe or Japan, or if you read very much of the same economic literature that I do about the U.S. future, that is not necessarily going to happen. And if it does happen, it happens outside of state budget windows, which do not include these years. Okay, state budget windows include these years. States are making, and of course, I don't know what this is, but states are making decisions about how to balance their budgets, and they cannot see and cannot count on that. If Congress sees and counts on this, they will be making decisions that are inconsistent with what's going to happen at the state level. Let me give you a little picture of Kansas. It's in the middle of the country in a lot of ways. Kansas expects approximately $1 billion additional dollars in Medicaid spending. That's all funds. That's the Medicaid, that's the federal share too, which is now just 56 or 57% in Kansas, over the next 5 years. So another $1 billion added to our spend. That's an annual number, not cumulative. That represents an average annual growth rate of 6.6%, which is nearly a percentage point lower than we've actually experienced over the last 10 years. So this is a conservative forecast of spending in Kansas Medicaid. Nationally, CBO projects long-run growth in Medicaid. It's hard to pick this out because the Affordable Care Act's been built into the base. I'm trying to not include the ACA in any of these numbers, just so we have an apples-to-apples comparison. They're projecting about the same rate of growth, or around 7, best I can tell. State Medicaid spending actually grew 20% over the last 2 years and is now expected to shrink 2.9% in fiscal year 2012. That's a different source. That's the Association of State Budget Officers. That's the first indication that you all should have that something very different is going on in Medicaid at the state level, and the future is not necessarily the past. This is hard to see. You may be able to see it better in print if you have copies. This is a much, much more detailed forecast of spending in Kansas over the next 5 to 7 years. You couldn't do this at the federal level because they really just don't have the database and methodology to handle it. It breaks spending projections down by which services and which populations are really driving growth. So you've seen already from Diane and from others, the very standard picture of Medicaid, which is, a small percentage of the beneficiaries, the dual eligibles, the disabled, and the elderly comprise most of the spending. Well, of course, that's going to translate into the greatest sources of growth in spending in the future. It turns out that even during recession years, the population shown here, which are the elderly and disabled, I've broken them out by whether they're in a community-based waiver or not, because that's such a big cost driver in Kansas. The elderly and disabled who are in waivers will account for more than a third of the growth in Medicaid in Kansas the next 5 years, you add the elderly and disabled who are not in those waivers, and you're well over half. And that's typical. And the recession and economic growth have something to do with that, but almost nothing. So you see potentially economically driven growth in Medicaid, and up here, about a quarter, and that's the medical care associated with, you know, moms and kids. So the old story of Medicaid being growth being driven by enrollment, which is being driven by recession and low income, I don't believe. That's just not what's happened in Kansas. We've had very large growth in Medicaid due to the recession in the last 2 years, but the costs are going up for other reasons. By the way, these numbers here are driven in part by what I would refer to as a very dysfunctional set of federal disability policies with exactly the wrong incentives built in. That is a simpler picture of what I just showed you, and just aggregates and again ascribes that $1 billion in growth in Kansas Medicaid to the two sort of fundamental populations in Medicaid, the aged and disabled, including the duals, and the moms and kids. This is not really an issue that the moms and kids can solve. So what are states doing about this? And I hear much the same story from other states. And certainly in the actions that they're taking, they're targeting the blue instead of the red. They have to. If Congress is going to solve this issue on its behalf, you'll have to. Provider fee reductions, although now there is some constraint on states' ability to reduce provider payments, which we do not want to do in the first place because Medicaid is not high payer in the room. They're not high payer in any room. But that's one of the only tools available to states, limited now by the proposed but in effect applied regulation, which says that from an interpretation of the Social Security Act, which says you can't really pay any less for providers unless you can prove that there won't be any impact on access. Very difficult to prove that in advance, especially for provider groups. They're essentially captured by the Medicaid program anyway. Expansion of managed care, we can talk more about that, to new populations, states, and regions. That is the path forward for Kansas, just announced this week. Tighter management or reductions in services. This is really one of the only remaining areas that states have a lot of freedom in. Now, the optional services in Medicaid really are a non-starter, because if you do not provide home and community-based services, you will see an immediate, well, you'd see an immediate human cost. You wouldn't have enough institutional beds, and those that did arrive in an institutional facility would cost you more. Pharmacy is an optional benefit. That's really not what states are doing. What states are trying to do is manage better, either directly or through MCOs. And by implementing payment reforms, implementation of care management. Kansas has chosen to do this through MCOs. Some states are attempting to do this, are well along in the process of doing this directly without the use of MCOs. And finally, integrating Medicaid and Medicare dual eligibles through shared savings models. There's a big asterisk on this one. That's if it turns out to be possible to do that at scale in the budget window that states have to work with to achieve savings on their behalf, given current authority at CMS, either through the Affordable Care Act and the dual eligible initiative there, or through traditional waiver or state plan amendment options in Title 19, we are very concerned at the association that it will take more help and more freedom to succeed. You will not see fraud and abuse on this list. It simply isn't worth our time. You cannot save meaningful dollars in Medicaid with additional new efforts in fraud and abuse. In future years, when the deficit demands are lower, it will make sense. It is not worth my time right now. It just isn't there. It would be, I would caution you, a waste of your time. and a fantasy to pursue it. You all know what you all are considering to reduce cost. I'll group them in three. First, trading federal dollars for state flexibility. This is the block grant idea. The next couple of ideas are to just purely shift costs to states. The next ideas are to realign the responsibilities, in particular for the high-cost duals population, either to shift it here or to totally shift it to the states. And finally, you can just redefine Medicaid. You could save money by repealing PPACA. You could save money by implementing PPACA, depending on which side of that debate you're on, and CBO. And you could simply reduce the entitlement. I would argue that most of those have to do with what states are going to do anyway and what they need from you and from CMS to make it happen. I have a number of predictions which I can get into in the Q&A more precisely. Number one, the biblical parable, the father was waiting and saw his son coming back and convened a party. States cannot see revenue coming back. Okay, they cannot see that far. There will be no party. Medicaid has to address the cost crisis before Congress budget window closes. You don't get Rosie's scenario. It's just not available to you. You can assume it. That's not how it's going to work out. States will need more tools. We're going to have to continue to expand managed care in many states because we don't have the staff to do these sorts of things directly. And finally, here's my prediction. Congress will not be able to shift Medicaid costs to states without first doing everything it can to support shared savings opportunity, in particular with the duals. So I'm going to stop there and wait for questions.
Great. Deanne?
Hi.
Red. Till the red light comes on.
Red is on now. Okay.
All right.
Hi, thank you for the invitation to be here. I was invited when Ed called to come and speak representing the consumer's interest, which apparently doesn't happen a whole lot in Washington. And so I will try to do that. I wanted to explain a little bit about what my organization does and then talk about the subject today. At Consumers Union, we are the publisher of Consumer Reports magazine, as many of you probably know. And when it comes to healthcare, we believe that consumers need to be empowered with really good information, verifiable, independent information that will help them make good choices in their healthcare, be that which health plan to go to, which kind of drug to use, what hospitals have the safest records in various and sundry types of treatments. We think that's very important. And we don't try to tell you which kind of car to buy. We try to give you all the different information about what cars have. And then you make your decision as to how much you can spend. But the key to all of that is value. We believe that you have to have value in anything that you're trying to buy. And that's the best price. But it's also something that meets your needs in the best way. And unfortunately, that is a concept that is really hard to apply to the healthcare system. It's easy to say, it is hard to do, as in many things with Medicaid. But we do think that that's an important principle, and I wish that I could come here and talk to you about that in the context of Medicaid. But I am also a recovering Medicaid director. It's been 16 years now. Hi, I'm Deanne.
Does it take that long?
Well, define recovery. But I spent 3 years running Medicaid in the state of Texas. It was the largest, second largest program in the country at the time, early 1990s. Oh, boy. And we faced a tremendous budget problem in the state of Texas. And we could not find a way to pay for it. This is the early 1990s. And so I am here to tell you that I have implemented managed care, not only for Star Plus, but also for SSI recipients, even a pilot project around behavioral health, all of which are going on in Texas. I helped move people from nursing homes into community-based services, 22,000 people through a waiver. I have, I'm ashamed to say, or maybe not ashamed to say, helped pass provider taxes to pay for the Medicaid program, helped design intergovernmental transfers to pay for the Medicaid program, designed the state's disproportionate share program, which would help finance Medicaid and our local services. But I had nothing to do with UPL, and I just want to be on the record to say that. I have incredible respect for Andy and the other Medicaid directors. It is a very difficult challenge that they have. But when I look at the kinds of things that are being recommended for the state level right now and even discussed at the national level, I have a warning, which is based on experience, and that is we have to be really, really careful what we are doing. It's important to remember that Medicaid, as has already been pointed out, takes care of extremely vulnerable people. And they are people who are facing difficult life challenges, whether it is the mom, who, by the way, does not drive a Rolls Royce. She instead is trying to figure out how to get her her child to the doctor. Can she afford the metro ticket? Does she have gas? Can her neighbor drive her there? If she takes her child and she has an hourly wage job, she's losing money. She's not, you know, she's not getting paid to take her child, so she needs to try to find services in Medicaid outside of the regular hours that many of us think that healthcare should, that healthcare is available and needs to be expanded. It's also a woman who finds out that she's pregnant and doesn't have health insurance. Half of all of the births in our country are paid now by Medicaid. And this is at a time when we're seeing increasing rates and numbers of induced delivery and C-sections and other things that are extraordinarily expensive. Well, Medicaid, our tax dollars, is helping to support that. And it's also, as mentioned, the primary long-term care system, really, for people. I cannot tell you how many people, when you speak to them, do not understand that nursing home care is not part of Medicare. It is not part of that entitlement that they have earned through their work. So it is an area that consumers do not understand. The other point I would like to make, so we have to keep in mind who these people are and that the changes will be affecting their lives, and we need to not do things that make it more difficult for them to get through their lives. Secondly, it's important, it's been pointed out, but I wanted to just say a little bit more about it. Medicaid is foundational, and in Washington we think about that in terms of state and federal relations, but when you are running it at the state level and you deal with providers at the local level, you understand that Medicaid really is the underpinning for all kinds of other state and local provided services for people who have no insurance whatsoever. So if you start doing too much with Medicaid, your public hospital, which, by the way, is the level one trauma center for the entire community, is devastated. And so we have to look at the ripple effects, not only with Medicaid, and as we look at our budgets for federal and state governments, we also have to see that those kinds of changes can have enormous implications at the state level, not just for Medicaid, but for people in the community, especially those without insurance. So the third point I'd like to make is that we are dealing with these budgets in Medicaid, but Medicaid cannot be looked at for enormous changes without seeing it as part of the bigger system. And by that I mean costs in healthcare are too high. We know that, but we have to deal with Medicaid in the context that it is a payer within a world where others are paying a lot more money. So we have to deal with the ideas that with Medicaid, you can't just make certain cuts and not expect it to have implications. When you're a Medicaid director, you go to the legislature and you say, we can cut eligibility, although that's limited now. We can cut benefits. We can cut provider payments. Or we can improve service delivery. And so what we did was we tried to solve one problem with managed care. I had a problem where I was paying enormous amounts of money for people, but they weren't being able to get in to see a doctor, and that troubled me deeply. So I thought, well, let's find a way to help people get into the care that they need. Let's explore managed care, which in Texas was a very difficult fight because the doctors didn't like it very much. So we went about setting up managed care. It has been implemented now for 16 years, 15 or 16 years. And the results actually at this point aren't very good. People still cannot find physicians. In Texas, 1 in 3 doctors take Medicaid. At the beginning of managed care, what I saw, which made me very happy, was that the managed care companies increased payments to doctors in order to attract them into the program and made their money by chopping hospital, which was too expensive in Texas. We paid hospitals very well. But through the years, I don't think that's happening anymore. And that's why we are seeing that physicians are, once again, avoiding going into Medicaid. So managed care is not a panacea. I think that states need flexibility, but we must make sure that the states have earned it. It is not something that should be granted whole hog across the country, in my opinion. There are too many states that will be too tempted to solve their budget problems by pushing it off onto a managed care company and not really understand that when that managed care company tells a person they have access to care, that means they have to be able to get to a doctor 60 miles away, which is what has been happening in Texas. So it's a cautionary tale, and I think that we need to be sure that we have a strong federal government that is overseeing this and making sure that the states are actually accomplishing and the managed care companies are actually accomplishing what they want. In terms of predictions on what will happen, I have no idea what will happen. I think that there are lots of ways that we can control health care costs that will have implications for Medicaid. Some of them have started to be worked on in the new in the PPACA and ACA. Things like tying payments to making sure that hospitals are controlling their hospital-acquired infections, stopping readmissions, things that are extraordinarily expensive. So those are the kinds of service delivery changes, unfortunately, take a lot of time. They don't pay back quickly. But it is the kind of thing that we need so that at the end of the day, we have a healthcare system that serves people, and in particular, our most vulnerable people, which are those people who are on Medicaid.
Great. Thank you very much, Deanne. Once again, you have the opportunity to ask questions. There are microphones at either side near the back of the room. If you fill out a green question card, you can see our staff moving through the tables, and they will bring them forward. I would also invite Bruce and Diane to weigh in with questions and comments at their discretion. Let me just kick things off. Oh, I will not kick things off. I would ask those of you who do go to the microphones to identify yourselves and keep your questions as brief as you can. Thanks.
Thank you very much. My name is Kevin Groner, and I've had the honor of working in multiple states, including Kansas, trying to connect individuals properly to the opportunities that benefit, say, Medicare, Medicaid, secondaries, things like that. One of the pieces that wasn't brought up, and Andy, I've heard you before in the past, and I love kind of your business background, finance, ability to kind of assess things and see things. But the one piece that I continue to come up against and recognize one of the most expensive pieces of what we're trying to manage, for sure, Deanne, the beginning of life, but the end of life. So if we're going to provide benefit, where can we get a little traction to kind of say, hey, look, we're going to provide this benefit and what we need from you, and you can change this at any time, but how can we get you to kind of give us a roadmap or at least a little guidance when it comes time for us to make a decision on, are we going the distance or are we going to say, okay, you may pass? And I know that's a very sensitive issue, but it's a very, very, very costly piece, that last time of our life, a couple weeks. How can we get folks that we're going to cover to recognize we need a little bit of an advance directive on how far do we go? Thank you.
I think I can answer that question fairly briefly. I don't think we can right now. I don't think that the cultural dinner table, legislative or congressional discussion in this country is anywhere near the level of maturity required to address that issue. I think we have some first things to address, and that would be the deficit issue in front of us today, which will require hard choices, maybe not that hard. I think that's a second stage question, not a first stage question.
Just to add to that, you know, I having been a practicing physician for a bunch of years and actually having in another part of my life worked in a managed care organization, you know, what I would say is there's something really different about all of us in the room and what a dual eligible person actually looks like. Most of us in the room today are healthy. Relatively so. We're not using the healthcare delivery system. And so much of managed care is sort of built on the notion that you don't use it most of the time. It's sort of why most people are happy with their healthcare coverage, because they don't use it. Most of us make our decisions about healthcare without actually being in the process of use. It is very, very different for the subset of people who are seriously chronically ill and using the system all the time. And that really gets at, well, what is the model of care that you then use for that subset of people? So for the relatively well people, you know, a somewhat barrier-driven system, which frankly managed care has as its core, you have a primary care provider, you start there, they're supposed to coordinate for you and on down the line. But it starts with the notion that you begin somewhere and there's a logical path. It's very different for somebody who's seriously ill and is using multiple providers. And, you know, if you look at the models that have been successful, they start with the notion that these folks are using the system all the time. So it isn't really about kind of that traditional pathway. It really is about accepting that notion that people use all the time, and that what you're really trying to do is help coordinate the care, make it easier for them to use services. So then back to your question, sort of this is sort of the wind-up to the answer. You know, the way we will get to better discussions about end-of-life care is to really move the discussion back to the hands of the individual, their families, and their providers, which is sort of a scary thing, and it sounds kind of antithetical to the principles of managed care, but it's really not. At the end of the day, that last mile in healthcare is really delivered by a doctor, a nurse, a social worker, a person, their family. It's very local. And to the degree that that's a really well-informed discussion and that there is care coordination around it, that the locus of control is not in the hands of the government, it's not in the hands of the managed care company, but it's back in the hands at the kind of provider person level, is really where the opportunity comes to change that discussion. But it's a really hard thing to do.
As you can see, by the way, we've asked Tim and Tony to rejoin us, so you should feel free to pepper any of them with your questions. And let's go to the microphone there.
I'm Dr. Caroline Poplin. I'm a general internist. Before I ask my question, I want to make one comment about the end-of-life business, and that's a retrospective determination. A lot of people don't know that their life is ending. And, for instance, when somebody has bypass surgery, you can't say, well, you know, that person had bypass surgery, and they died a month later, so they shouldn't have had it. You have to look at all the people who had bypass surgery like that and find out how many of them died the next month, because that's how you look at it in advance, to say, well, you shouldn't have this at the end of life, you don't know that that's what's coming. That you only know that after the fact. My question was completely different. It sounds like what you're saying is that Medicare provides just health services, but Medicaid provides other services. And one of the problems with Medicare is it's just health services, so it forces everything into the health situation. As a well-known author on geriatrics said, at the end of life or near the end, Medicare is paying for all the wrong things. So you can get surgery, but you can't get what you'd call community health-based services under Medicare. And I wanted to know if that is what you're saying, because that's something new to me.
You know, I think the simple answer to your question is yes. I mean, Medicare is built as an acute care medical, acute and chronic care delivery system program, but it is really about being in a medical model. I'm not saying, let me be clear, that there are a few places where Medicare does provide some specific services. So there's the 100 nursing home days for subacute and rehab, and you know, you can do a little bit of home health stuff in Part B. I mean, we could have a really wonky Medicare discussion here. But it's not its primary purpose. Its primary purpose was medical care. And if you think back to what 1965 looked like when it passed, you know, most people didn't have that many chronic illnesses, and to the degree something happened to you, if you survived it, great, and if you didn't, you didn't. But you didn't have a world full of ICUs and MRIs and all the invasive technology we have today. So the reality is we have people in the last 50-odd years who live, and the point is they live. They live with serious chronic illness and functional limitation. And how do you address the independence and dignity that they want? And a lot of that programmatic work is actually born on the back of the Medicaid program for the folks who qualify for it.
So maybe Medicare should look more like Medicaid.
And have the states run it.
Hmm?
And have the states run it.
Not for me.
Not that part of it. No, just the benefits part.
Hi, Tom Curry. I'm a reporter with MSNBC.com. I had two questions about the people who will be newly eligible for Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. The first question is, when the CBO estimates what it will cost to provide, to cover them under Medicaid, have they factored in the fact that these people may not have had sufficient care, there's going to be a pent-up demand, and so that they may be sicker than expected, so the cost of treating them or covering them may be greater than people, greater than CBO expected. And my second question is really a very simple kind of 10,000-foot question, and maybe simplistic, but how can you expand eligibility by a third for Medicaid, and yet the supercommittee, some reports say they're hoping to achieve savings of $50 billion out of the Medicaid program. How can you expand eligibility by a third, but also be reducing the projected future outlays?
There's no one from CBO on this panel, but I will say that in most of the estimates of adding new eligibles to a program like to the Medicaid program or just to private insurance coverage, there is some estimate included for pent-up demand for people who have delayed services until they get insurance or have been underutilizing services. So that is generally part of the cost estimate, though the greatest thing driving the cost estimate is actually the participation rate, how many people who become newly eligible will actually come onto the program and utilize the program services.
Let me suggest that before we wring our hands too much over $50 billion, we're going to be spending something in the neighborhood of $4 to $4.5 trillion on Medicaid in the next 10 years. Now, 1% of $4 trillion is $40 billion. CBO is, if it is very, very, very lucky, their margin of error at 10 years is 3%. If you look at historically, it's something around 50%, but 3% is very good. So $50 billion isn't within the margin of error of the estimating. That is, we may spend more, may spend less, independent of what we do.
Okay.
I might just add one thing to that. From the state perspective, you have to be careful about make sure you're following all the money in the healthcare system when you look at the impact of expansion of reform. So states already spend money on the uninsured. What happens to that in 2014? Maybe another way to look at it is how much money is in the healthcare system now to pay for the care that's provided? How much of that pent-up demand is there when you cover these people, which is obviously one of the goals of covering them? They have pent-up needs, okay? So the Affordable Care Act did cost something. I would just urge caution in focusing too much on any one piece of that and assuming that that the numbers don't add up.
Yes, may I say something? I think that that's an incredibly important point because many, many localities and many states have other programs that never register up here. One of the things that happened when we designed our DISH program was to take local property tax dollars that had been being spent for decades in the hundreds of millions of dollars in all of the major cities in Texas, most of the major cities in Texas, and we turned that into a match because basically we were helping to cover people who my state had chosen not to cover through Medicaid. But those services were being rendered. And unfortunately, lots of times in the most expensive and too late in the process to really save money. So I think it's a very important point, and I think it's been missed in the healthcare debate.
And if I could, I just want to add one of the things that I meant to be covering was so much of the current system and the future system is predicated on Medicaid that if you end up looking for short-term savings in the Medicaid program, they'll reverberate out over a longer period. So if you end up having, in order to save this rounding error that Tony's talking about, the $50 billion, by shortchanging provider payments, then you'll have fewer participating providers at exactly the moment that you have more people coming in, and it'll be scary. I agree with the question of how can you reduce and expand at the same time. There may be some ways that are harmless to provider participation, but I haven't heard of people talking about them yet. So.
I'm Doug Trapp with American Medical News. This is directed at Tony and Tim mostly. Hoping you can sort of extend your arguments a little bit for me. Typically when people don't want something, they tend to talk about the cost of it, and if they do, they don't talk about the cost of it so much. And it seems like your arguments both kind of followed those lines pretty closely. So I'm wondering, Tony, if you think that there shouldn't be as much money spent on Medicaid and healthcare, and if so, if you could talk about, you know, a reason for having less spent on that or constraints and justify not doing that. And also, Tim, if you believe it should be spent, if you can come up with some justification for where that money comes from or, you know, how you keep that on track with what the needs are that you outlined.
Actually, that's how Tim and I have gotten along together for 30 years. No, I don't think that's the issue. I think there's a reality issue out there, which is where are the resources going to come from? It's not an issue of what I want. I ran a Medicaid program. I understand, and I think I was reasonably understanding it when I ran it. But the fact of the matter is the Medicaid program at the state level is growing faster than the state tax base. And the same thing is true at the federal level. Now, as the old economist, I can't remember his name, once said, you know, unsustainable growth rates are unsustainable. And at some point, we've got to figure out how to change it. But it's not a choice in the sense of like or don't like. It's a fact of the matter that we've got a fiscal situation that is unsustainable, and a $300 or $400 or $500 billion program can't be exempted, and certainly can't be increased. So the question is, what's the best way to deal with that problem? But I don't think it's a like or not like. I think that casts it in entirely the wrong terms.
Yeah, it's a simple way of saying it, but. But what's,
I'm sorry?
The question you said that what is the way of dealing with it? Do you have a sense of what you want to do?
No, look, I'm retired. I don't get paid for that anymore. But more importantly, No, I don't. But I think the problem is the people and the advocates have got to figure, the advocates and those who are the experts in health policy have got to come up with ways to deal with the problem, because if they don't, someone who knows a lot less about this program is going to make the decisions for you.
If I can, and Tony and I have been friends for 30 years, so I think we understand each other talking. I don't think Tony's comments, as they were placed, were saying this is useless spending, go ahead and get rid of it, or let's cost shift it onto the states. I think he was just sort of painting for us how bleak the revenue side of the picture is, and how bleak the cost curve is. And just sort of saying, okay, put your money where your mouth is if you really believe in this program, without him wanting to be Sophie choosing among his children of whether to give up long-term care or give up primary care or something like that. In turn, I'm going to do the same thing. I don't want to pick and choose among them because I think those programs are good programs, as I think came through. I can give you some macro ideas that will be no surprise. Diane Rowland started with one of them. Healthcare costs generally are wildly out of control, and Medicaid will come back into control if we can figure out how to control healthcare costs, because Medicaid is actually better controlled than private sector costs are. People in this room will be more than sensitive to the idea that a lot of people think there should be some revenues raised to deal with some of these questions, too. That's far beyond my pay grade and expertise. The one thing that I would point you at is something that I think is quite specific and has been explored. It's just the Congress doesn't have the political will to do it, is to look at how much we're paying for prescription drugs. We have documentation that we're paying in Medicare way more than we need to pay in Medicare for prescription drugs, because we pay less in Medicaid. So the idea that we could undo some aspect of a deal long made about how pharma gets paid under Medicare in order to find some money to pay for the services that, you know, that I think are good and that Tony thinks are good. You know, there are some things that we could go through, and I can go through a CBO list of possible changes here. But I think both of those, is Tony's other point, I think both of these are sort of tinkering on the edges. The real things here are there revenues, and are there a way of bending the healthcare cost curve? So, is that responsive?
Let me only add one other point. Back to my point before, I think if you think about dealing with the long-term care issues, the substance and mental health abuse programs, and the disability programs in a way that is completely different from the way you've thought about it before, go talk to your social services side and talk to them about how they might deal with it. Because we in this room, I think, and I'm going to make a gross generalization here, think in terms of what doctors do in hospitals and clinics and so forth. That is not relevant to those three other programs as I've defined them. And I think there are ways of managing them better.
All right. Rodney Whitlock, Senator Grassley.
Here comes trouble.
I'll insult you yet, Tim. Don't worry about it. I want to make a case and then get reaction from the panel. That the reason we're having this conversation today and the reason that there is a focus on Medicaid is because there's a presumption that Medicaid spends too much. Okay? I am not convinced that's the case, and I'm not convinced that there's sufficient evidence out there that Medicaid spends too much. I think there's significant evidence out there that Medicaid spends a lot. Now, I think, Andy, you can speak to that from the Kansas perspective and all of you from the various states' perspective, that Medicaid definitely at a state level spends a lot. But if you look at where Medicaid spends its dollars, Medicaid is, you know, as Diane, you described, I mean, it's an extraordinarily efficient provider of services. It pools federal and state money together. It funnels those to, you know, providers who then provide services to the beneficiaries. And if you're looking for actual evidence, okay, Zuckerman et al. 2009 in Health Affairs, okay, that piece showed that their, you know, every six-year survey he's done, that on the acute side nationally, the average is about 72% of Medicare rates are paid to Medicaid providers. So if you believe that Medicaid spends too much, and it is simply just an efficient provider of services, you know, from pulling dollars and paying them to providers, and those providers are being paid 72% of Medicare rates, then if you really believe that, okay, then you have no business supporting a fix of the SGR, and the private market criminally overpays providers. Okay. I don't think anybody believes that. But what we do see is Medicaid spends a lot of money. Okay? I think the real problem here and that draws us to this is not that Medicaid spends too much, it's that Medicaid does too much. And I'll walk you through a set of people. Okay, a healthy 5-year-old kid, a 14-year-old profoundly autistic child, a 20-year-old who has aged out of the foster care system, okay, a 26-year-old pregnant woman, a 43-year-old paraplegic, a 66-year-old just aging into retirement, and an 83-year-old with severe dementia in a skilled nursing facility. Okay. Medicaid is the only program in America that puts all of those people under one umbrella. Medicaid is the only place in this country where we take a look at those people and go, hey, they look alike to me. Okay. That's utterly nuts and continues to be utterly nuts. And what it's doing is it's drawing the thunder and lightning to Medicaid. Okay. And I'll make the case that the Medicaid program would be better served if we actually broke it down into its constituent parts, into its constituent populations, most easily, you know, the healthy populations, non-elderly healthy populations, elderly, and then disabled, non-elderly disabled. Because absent that, what you have is this urge to say, you know, come up with intellectually vacuous ideas like, hey, Medicaid spends a lot of money, let's do X minus 10. Or, hey, there's, you know, grotesque spending here, let's just, you know, let's go with a price control regime, right, Tim? And use that instead. That Medicaid is not going to become more efficient until we are able to actually look at each of the populations and the spending within, but because it's under this one gigantic umbrella, our approach to it is, let's just go X minus 10. It's easy.
I guess my question, or my question in response, and it's really a question, is, okay, you disaggregate the various functions and populations of Medicaid. And surprisingly enough, the federal government actually does that when it runs it out of CMS. You know, there's an Office of Family and Kids. There's one for disabled and elderly. There's one for nursing homes. So you disaggregate that. Where are your savings coming from? I mean, you can say more efficiency, but if you're talking about disaggregating that and then finding savings from it, it suggests to me that there's some services or beneficiaries that aren't going to be provided, the services that you're not going to cover or beneficiaries that are not going to be served.
But don't you think the style of services being provided, particularly when you're, and the biggest example of that is the elderly and non-elderly disabled, the idea of the duals, and Bruce, you knocked this around here. The duals are two wholly different populations, but we think, again, when we think of dual eligible policy in this country, that we think that a 34-year-old quadriplegic and an 83-year-old with severe dementia are the same people.
But again, I'm not arguing with the idea that you might want to disaggregate those people and design services. I just don't see how you get savings out of that because, hold on for one second, because it's like saying we're going to prohibit covering pregnancy in the Medicare program. If the service isn't widely used, you don't get many savings from it. So in order, if you break it down and say, okay, I'm going to treat the autistic kid differently because he's autistic, which services that are currently, not just which services are is he eligible for, he's not using the pregnancy service when he's over 65. Which services is he eligible for using and then you're going to cut back on because you want to get some savings out of it?
I think if you look at the spending, particularly the piece that came out of Kaiser very recently, that the drivers, particularly on the long-term supports and services size, as it relates to the above 65 and below 65 populations, that clearly, and CBO has borne this out again and again and again, that anything you do to try to increase participation in home-based services in the over 65 population is an extreme cost driver. Below, it is treated very differently, and that we have a program that assumes those to be the same and makes it even, frankly, difficult for states to approach it that way. Would you disagree that it is difficult for states to divide those populations for the purposes of providing those services?
Well, you can do targeted waivers and targeted case management there, but you know, if you're telling me that there's something about the woodwork effect there, and now maybe you and I should just get a room. if there's something about the woodwork effect here that's different for the younger people with disabilities and the older people with disabilities, then maybe that's true. I don't know.
Yeah, just from the state's point of view, it's not that hard to disaggregate them, and yes, we do. So I showed you that picture. We absolutely break our program into its component populations and services, and they're very different. What we've noticed is the greatest potential for savings in Kansas is actually coordinating an individual who may have both community-based service needs and they're also driving our medical spend as well. They may have behavioral health needs as well. We currently treat them as three different people, managed by three, in our state, three different agencies with three different core sets of providers, and never the three shall meet. So that's the challenge that we're addressing in Kansas. A lot of states are addressing that challenge. It's one of the motives for expanded managed care, which is not a panacea and must be overseen. It's a vehicle to bring those things together. Yeah, we can track them separately. Medicaid is a financing source. It's not a program. Absolutely. But states know that, and that's where we're focusing our efforts. I think it'd be very helpful for Congress to look at it that way, just so you don't broadly assume. You can just always save 10% because we think it's inefficient.
But Andy, if I may, once you disaggregate them and have these three different treatment teams and those kinds of things, do you get savings by doing that? Or do you just get improved patient outcome? Not just improved patient outcome, but...
No, both. That's exactly. So our, you know, what we're attempting in Kansas and what we've laid out as a challenge to the private marketplace is we want you to save money. Mm-hmm. We want you to do that by improving care. And we're linking those two incentives together. So you will not make money in Kansas if you come in and just try to reduce access to services. You will lose money as an MCO if you do that. If you reduce care by coordinating, and for the first time ever, presenting our developmental disability population with an emphasis on its preventive medical needs. You know that they live 20 years less than the rest of us. Yeah, we think that's both going to improve quality and reduce inpatient and other unnecessary spending.
My name is Brian Collins. I'm with the Health Initiative. And I was really glad that Andrew threw up on his slide in the list of potential strategies for states of moving toward a share savings model for the duals. And we've seen Oregon already, you know, is in the process of asking CMS for a waiver to start to do that. And not only that, but move their Medicaid system to where each community has a group of doctors and hospitals and mental health professionals who would then just get one check and then be responsible for sharing that money and providing services to their community. And when the legislature was looking into this, kind of what their conversation was is, look, Medicaid's never going to have enough money to do all that it's supposed to do, so why not shift the decision-making down to the community level and empower providers and hospitals to spend that in the most effective way possible through care management and helping people stay out of the emergency room and so forth. And since payment reform and moving away from fee-for-service is something that a lot of folks are talking about, Massachusetts is looking at something, could Medicaid be a good vehicle for broader reforms along these lines to really shift decision-making down to the community level and to move away from a fee-for-service type model?
I would love to address that question. That was a key question in the National Association's fall meetings the last 3 days here in D.C., just down the road. And many of our sessions and many of our Medicaid directors and many of our states are attempting just that. I think that there's always the question of where leadership will come from. And it is hard to get away from the centering standards-driven, the standards that the Medicare program drives. So the payment methodology, et cetera, for Medicare drives the entire system. It is hard to get away from that. It is also hard to imagine, having at least many of us lived through or watched the last 2 or 3 years in the healthcare debates, it is really hard to imagine additional sufficient leadership in the very difficult challenges of payment reform and systems reform coming from Washington. Many of us just do not believe that's possible. And so what's left is for states to do it, and many states are stepping up to the plate.
If I may.
Go ahead.
If I may,
I'm not even going to address the discussion of how to coordinate Medicare and Medicaid services better. I'm sure that that is certainly possible to coordinate those services better. But when you asked me earlier about where is the upper payment limit in today's world, in order to figure out how to do state management of dual-eligible Medicare, Medicaid beneficiaries, and give the cash back to the states, which is sort of what one of the models is, somebody's going to have to figure out how much that Medicare beneficiary or that class of Medicare beneficiaries was going to use and convey that check back to the states. I'm not sure that we've got the data to be able to figure that out. I also am not sure that we have the political will to be able to figure that out. And I'm very concerned that if you give that huge a chunk of Medicare money to a state that is cash-strapped and already trying to figure out what it's going to do with its next Medicaid-only beneficiary that present company accepted, some state legislatures are going to look at this incoming Medicare influx of money and say, well, that's how we'll do it. And, you know, during upper payment limit, states were backing out their state payments into and leaving the federal government entirely in charge. My ears start to tingle when I hear about writing these giant checks from the Medicare program, handing it to states and saying, and this is what we estimate, and you can't back out any of your money.
Thank you. I'm Bob Helms from AEI. Tony McCann earlier made some predictions about what he thought the Congress would do under certain circumstances about taxes, and I'd like to get back to asking a question about sort of politics. A lot of my conservative friends complain that what's wrong with Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security is that they're open-ended entitlements. They're not subject to annual appropriations and so on. And they propose some sort of block grant or some fixed payment system. My question to you, well, in Medicaid, you've got the incentives for a federal match. When times are good in the state, expand the program because the federal government pays at least 50%. But if times are bad, don't cut Medicaid. That's sort of the last thing you cut because you have to share the savings with the federal government. So there's an incentive, a ratchet effect to keep expanding Medicaid relative to other programs in the federal budget. Now think ahead, suppose my conservative friends get their way and you could actually go to some sort of fixed payment. I have two questions. One, what do you people think the body politic would actually do? Would they cut back Medicaid or would they expand it? It's not obvious to me what that answer would be. And then at the state level, sort of, states differ in a lot of ways, but what states do you think would expand Medicaid if they knew they were getting a fixed payment and they didn't have the incentive to game it at the margin? So what states would expand it and what states would cut it back?
I might just address the second part of that question. You can't really answer the question unless you assume the Affordable Care Act or you assume it is not there. Because the Affordable Care Act sort of completes the circle, at least with regard to eligibility and service, and other than potentially long-term care services and supports, it answers that question of how big Medicaid should be, which has been the primary policy debate about Medicaid since it was created. Affordable Care Act answers the question of how big it, or at least in scope, how big it should be. I have to believe if you cut states a check and that was basically it, that you would not see the same sort of cost growth in the future that you've seen in the past. The fact is, with regard to Medicaid, nobody associated with the system, the beneficiary, nor the state, nor the federal government, pay full price. And as an economist, I would predict that means we all overspend.
Tony?
Let me make a suggestion again about thinking about different parts of the program. I think, for example, for the developmental disability community, as you know, many of the advocates, first of all, rail against the medical model. And much of the resources that are spent essentially on maintaining individuals with developmental disabilities in the community IGs and others to the contrary notwithstanding, and supporting them in the school system. In Maryland, we spent a lot of money in the school system to, quote, treat, unquote, people with developmental disabilities. I think you could, for example, come up with a system that would pay a fixed amount for people depending on the level of disability, which would act like a block grant, and then put in behind it some kind of a, quote, health insurance, which would provide support and treatment for the individual when their health status changed relative to their current health status. Now, I'm not here to say that that's necessarily a good or bad idea, but it is, given the nature of the program, a different approach, which might well be politically acceptable and might even be programmatically acceptable for that community, where it clearly would not, rightly or wrongly, for, say, the acute care population.
If I could also, Bob, I mean, what we're discussing here by passing, by turning things into a block grant is really, as opposed to open-ended, is really passing to someone the risk of what healthcare cost growth in the future is going to be. And some of the governors have recognized that and said, you know, therefore don't give me a block grant because I want you, the feds, to bear a lot of the risk of what healthcare costs are going to grow to be in the future. And others have said, you know, I'll figure it out how to whittle down the program along the way. So it seems to me that unless somebody figures out a way of how to bend the cost curve of healthcare expenses, then the states will be given a fixed amount of money for a growing set of expenses, and states will have to, you know, sort of, you know, burn the furniture in order to be able to keep going with the basic, with what they consider to be the basic services along the way. From the Fed side, I think you can look, and Tony would know better than I because we're talking about appropriated funds here. But if you, I think if you go back and look at the appropriated block grants, that over time those dollars atrophy. That the programs, the block grants become stagnant as the Congress loses interest in it, since they're all things to all states, and as the Congress decides it wants more specificity in what it's deciding to pay for, it wants to be a, if not prudent purchaser, at least a specific purchaser. And so that the block grants have over, since the beginning of those block grants during the Reagan era, have atrophied over time, and so the federal support actually diminishes. So unless there's some kind of inflator built into federal and state side, it seems to me that you're looking at the possibility of a Fed side diminishing, a state side being insufficient to keep up with health care costs.
Howard? Yeah, go ahead.
Howard Cohn, the Majority Energy and Commerce Committee. First of all, I had the pleasure of working both with Tim and Tony over the years. So it's good to see them both on the same panel. And Tony, you have to unretire.
Is that like uncool?
Absolutely. This is really a challenge more to Diane and to Ed and the people that are funding these various lunches and seminars. I'd like to see you do a session or two which said something like, inside deficit reduction, what happens when the budget committee tells you to save $300 billion over Medicaid over 10 years? And that would sort of be the title and the directive, and then have people work through that. Are there people on, I assume there are people in this room from the budget committees of the House or the Senate, and, well, maybe not.
There
but
are.
The real exercise up here is, if you work reconciliation, and I put aside the super committee, is budget committees give you targets to hit. And they say you have to hit these targets in reconciliation over a 10-year period. And the problem with Medicaid as compared to Medicare is Medicare has a million payment dials. So you can dial up physician payments or hospitals, and you can hit targets just by dialing up or down. Medicaid has one, which is prescription drugs, and that's it. So what it, excuse me?
And the FMAP.
And the FMAP, but no one's really fooled with the FMAP any in the past or probably in the future. So the problem is, going forward, is when you get a big number from the budget committee, it could be a Democratic budget committee or a Republican budget committee in Medicaid, and they say, save the money, you have to go to structural reform. And when you're in structural reform, it's a whole different way to try to rethink the program. So that's why I think that would be a really interesting session. It's something maybe Kaiser or Ed's group doesn't necessarily do every day, but That is the exercise. And as Tony said, 5 years now and 10 years now, when it's the banks or the Chinese holding the debt, they don't care about Medicaid. All these programs end up as budget numbers on a spreadsheet. Believe me. And Tim has been there and Tony's been there many times. And basically the issue is hit the number. We don't care how you hit the number, but hit the number. And if you don't hit the number, we as the budget committee or the will hit the number for you. And I think that's where we're sort of going. I think that was Tony's remark, which I think was really critical. So I'll stop there. And it's not really a question. It's more just a request that you think about that.
Well, Howard, I was going to say at the end of this session that I'm not sure we gave the super committee any suggestions for how to achieve whatever targets they're looking for. And I think we go back to Tim's constant question of where are the savings, and that is a good challenge to all of us. We know you are going to be challenged with that task as well. And I think it would be a useful thing to begin to look beyond just prescription drugs at where the savings may really be in both going forward and in delivering better care.
Any final words from our other panelists? Or Bruce? Let me just make one final pitch for your filling out the evaluation form as you go. We've already had Howard Cohn's suggestions for what to put on that form, but we'd be interested in your ideas too. We are planning to do some briefings in the spring about overall healthcare costs, as several of the panelists have referred to, as a way to not only deal with the problem of Medicaid increases, but Medicare, private insurance, employer-paid coverage, and all of the rest. So we'd welcome your suggestions on the kinds of programs and the kinds of speakers that would be most useful to you in your work. Meantime, let me once again thank our sponsors of the series, our sponsors' leadership in the person of the co-moderators, Diane and Bruce, today, and ask you to help me thank our panel for an enlightening, if somewhat troubling, discussion.